So as we found out last week, taking 2 Samuel in sections rather than one or two chapters at a time makes reading the entire text out loud onerous. We spent about 15 minutes listening to the first 4.5 chapters. And so as we plunge in to the second section of this book, which starts at chapter 5, verse 11, and runs through the end of chapter 8, we're not going to read the entire text aloud. I hope you had an opportunity to look at it beforehand, but we'll stay close to the text throughout. So, at the end of the first section, David conquers Jerusalem and makes it his capital, but his power is not yet consolidated. He has eliminated his competitor in the northern kingdom. But this is a brand new thing in the life of Israel. Nobody really knows what it's supposed to look like or how it's supposed to work. And so David, as we see in these chapters, under Yahweh's guidance, works toward the consolidation of his power. He forms a viable line of succession, which we see early on in chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. He begins to establish diplomatic relationships with some of his neighbors, particularly King Hiram of Tyre, which turns into a trading relationship. But for the most part, he conquers people who border Israel. There's a whole sequence of battles and victories that are detailed in chapter 8. He gets rid of the Philistines and their ongoing threat. Perhaps most importantly, in chapter 6, he restores the ark to centrality, bringing it to Jerusalem. This is to make him not a replacement or a competitor to God, but as someone chosen and anointed and legitimate, reigning as a kind of a viceroy. And because, like I said, this is a brand new thing. Saul, as the first king, he was kind of in an intermediate sort of role between judge and king as Israel came to know it. And so certainly there would have been some resistance, some resentment, and there were still people who supported Saul and felt like that his descendants, among the very few that were left, should have inherited the throne. Now, this section also serves a much broader purpose in Hebrew scripture and the history of the people, in that Samuel and Kings, both books, all four of which were once one book, were put together, as we've discussed before, from a variety of sources, both oral and written. And these were brought together sometime during the Babylonian exile of the 8th century BCE, or afterwards, when people were released to go back home. And people in this period of time needed to understand what went wrong. That's basically what the prophets are trying to do. They forewarn the people that their way of life is unpleasing to Yahweh. They warn them what will happen if they don't change, and they tell them the change that they need to make. The prophets are uniformly ignored. It's believed that many of the prophetic books were assembled in their current form during and immediately after the exile, because, as it turns out, the prophets were right, and this helped people understand why it seemed as if God had forsaken them by allowing them to be conquered and carted off in slavery. And, of course, part of it has to be, to what extent did the monarchy have something to do with this awful event in our life? To what extent was it to blame? As we remember from our study of 1 Samuel, God was not excited about this idea of Israel having a king, which people clamored for because they thought it would make them stronger and because it was kind of the thing to do. All their neighbors had kings, so peer pressure being what it is, they wanted a king as well. And God warned them through the prophet Samuel, you know, you don't know what you're asking for. When you get a king, things aren't going to be that great because the king is going to exploit you to the hilt. He's going to take your kids as cannon fodder, your daughters as servants and maids, and to be part of his harem. And so there were a lot of questions around this, and we see this in Samuel and Kings, these sort of slightly different perspectives on the kingship in terms of, from the prophetic vantage point, it not being a good idea and it being a central cause for the disruption of the covenant that Israel had with God. Yet on the other hand, a sense in which the kingship was something that God was reluctant to grant, but did so anyway because in God's foresight he understood that this would serve his overall salvific purposes in Israel. But some saw the kingship in a brighter light, and they felt that the covenant that God made with David in chapter 7 indicated that somewhere down the line there would be another anointed one, another Messiah like David, who would do what he did in terms of, you know, providing security and prosperity to the people. Because in 7, and we're going to look at all this closer as we go through it bit by bit, in chapter 7, you know, God tells David, you know, from time to time I'll punish as deserved, but it's not going to be like Saul, where I completely withdraw my presence and become an enemy to the new king. It's not going to be like that. And rooted in this is the sort of messianic anticipation that you see woven through Judaism and then realized in Christianity. And this is just so different from what's gone before. I mean, in the Mosaic Law, it's called the conditional if. If you do or don't do so and so and such, then I, God, will do or won't do such and so and such and such. And so in a way, this new covenant with David culminates the one that God established with Abraham, and to a certain extent even exceeds it in its unconditionality. And so people way back when, reading chapter 7, could see, okay, it's been a rough 70 years in exile, but it's all right, because this was just a temporary passing thing. We've been punished, we deserved it, but now God will restore things to the way they were, just like he promised David in chapter 7. Now, as we look at this second section and its organization, there are basically two groups of three with corresponding elements in each for comparison. And I'm taking this from Walter Brueggemann's commentary in the Interpretation series. And on the second page of your notes, what you'll see is two parallel lists, 1 through 3 and then 3 through 1. You have the list of the family, chapter 5, verses 13 through 16, the Battle of the Philistines, chapter 5, verses 17 through 25, Ark as Old, chapter 6, 1 through 20, and then in the right-hand column, you see 3 prime, Oracle as New Claim in chapter 7, verse 1 through 29. And that is matched up with the Ark. Okay, so this is what's called a chiastic organization. So you've got the Ark. It's been restored. That's important for reasons that we'll discuss very soon. But the oracle from God to the prophet Nathan, which is then passed on to David, who then goes to the Ark and prays with God and receives this wonderful promise of a new covenant, this is, in essence, superseding the role of the Ark. And then 2 prime in that right-hand column, Battle with Two Nations, which is covered in chapter 8, verses 1 through 14, that is meant to be contrasted with the Battle of the Philistines in chapter 5. And again, as we'll see in greater detail, with the Philistines, they kept fighting defensive battles. Oh, the Philistines are coming. Guess we better get our act together. But in chapter 8, once the Philistine threat has been laid down, essentially, David goes on an offensive rampage. Okay, they're not fighting for their lives anymore. They're fighting for plunder and for property and for preeminence in the region. And then at the very bottom of that right-hand column, 1 prime, the list of officials at the very end of chapter 8, that goes with the list of the family at the very beginning of this section in chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. Because as the kingship is solidly established, what you see is the emergence of a bureaucracy to administrate it. And this supersedes the role of family. Okay? So, as Brueggemann writes, in each pair, the second element is contrasted with the first. Thus, the list of officers displaces the list of the children as the monarchy moves from kinship toward bureaucracy. The battle with the Philistines is replaced by more expansive battles as David no longer struggles for survival, but now is involved in territorial expansion. At the center, the old precious ark is superseded by Nathan's oracle, which bespeaks a radical innovation in Israel, breaking David free of the old tribal loyalties carried with the ark. Okay? So that's second section overall. Any questions about that before we jump in and take this apart piece by piece? All right. So I don't know about you, but it strikes me as odd that in chapter 5, verse 11, King Hiram sends messengers in the presence of some cedar trees along with some skilled builders to make David a nice house. And in verse 12, David then perceived that the Lord had established him king over Israel and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. That just blows me away. Of all the things that have happened up until this point, the fact that King Hiram would be nice enough to send him some lumber and some guys to build him a house, it finally dawns on David, wow, I'm king. I mean, I suppose that, you know, it's the little things that make a big difference. And then we have the list of David taking more concubines and wives when he gets to Jerusalem. Again, this is a symbol of a king. The sons that were born to David in Jerusalem are listed. Most of them play no role of any significance in the subsequent narrative. You see Solomon sort of in the middle there, and then when you combine Solomon with the sons who were born to David before he moved to Jerusalem, it puts Solomon 10th in line. 10th in line. Obviously, along the way, some things happened to most of these sons that precede Solomon in the line of succession. There are few left in 1 Kings, and once we get there, we'll review how Solomon wound up on top, thanks to some handy palace intrigue. When the Philistines find out that David has been set up as king, they're not very happy. You'll remember that as we ended 1 Samuel, there was a big battle. The Philistines defeated Israel, routed them, really. The king was killed, and David wasn't a part of that battle because the commanders of the Philistines didn't trust this guy. You know, they're like, he's not going to fight against his own people. He's going to turn on us, and we're going to have an enemy right in our midst. So they forced King Achish to send David back to Ziklag, which was sort of a feudal estate that the king had given him. And so here's David as a vassal of the king, and he's gotten a promotion because apparently he's been given the authority to administrate this newly conquered territory. And what does he do? He sets himself up as a king. So he's a rebel. He's too big for his britches. So the Philistines decide to attack. And David asks God, should I fight them? Will you let me win? Yes, no questions that, you know, suggest that he was using the ephod that contained the Urim and the Thummim. And God said, oh yeah, absolutely, go fight him, I'll lead you to victory. And so it happens as God says, and the Philistines abandoned their idols and David and his men took them away. And that was a consistent symbol in the ancient world. When you defeated an enemy, if you could capture their idols, there just wasn't much worse than that. Just like with battle flags, right? If you could, if you could capture a battle flag in a war like the Revolutionary War or one of the Napoleonic Wars or even the Civil War, that was a clear sign of an opponent's defeat. But the Philistines come back for more, and so got David again emphasizing his reliance upon Yahweh to guide him. says, so what should I do? And God here gives him some tactical advice. He says, here's what you're going to do. Don't make a frontal assault. Instead, swing around to the rear. There's this little copse of trees there. That'll give you concealment. And then when you hear the breeze blowing through the leaves, that's the time when you strike. And David does exactly as he's instructed, and he wins another great victory, and the Philistines don't come back. At this point, they're done as a major threat to Israel's security. They'll pop back up, just be mentioned in chapter 8, verse 1. This is the point at which finally they're safe. When we get into chapter 6, the Ark of the Covenant comes back on the scene. And it's kind of odd. It happens suddenly. No real reason is given as to why. And, you know, the Ark has been missing from the story for a long time. This is the first time it's been mentioned since 1 Samuel 7, verses 1 through 2. Now, as you'll remember, in 1 Samuel 6, it played a significant role in helping Israel win some victories against the Philistines. And the Philistines ended up capturing it in the end. But everywhere it went, it created tremendous suffering to the point where they wanted desperately to get rid of it. And the Israelites, after hearing what happened to the Philistines, weren't 100% sure they wanted it back. I mean, this is a sacred artifact of immense power. It's incredibly unpredictable and had done some horrific things. And so a guy named Abinadab, he had the guts to take care of it for a while, which he apparently did for 20 years. Okay? So the Ark hasn't played a role in anything that's been happening for 20 years, and maybe they were afraid to use it. Maybe they did use it, but for whatever reason, the narrator just doesn't include that element in the story. Or maybe they, under Saul, were so deluded about where their power came from that they just didn't bother using the Ark. But whatever the case, it's time for the Ark to come out of retirement and get back in action, because it has a role to play now, and that is to further secure the legitimacy of David as king. To quote again from Walter Brueggemann, the Ark embodies what is unifying among the tribes and clans of Israel. The Ark articulates and embodies for old Israel the holy rule of Yahweh. David's new regime in Jerusalem is a radical departure from that old order, and as such, is in urgent need of legitimation. Okay? So David taking hold of the Ark bolsters his position because, again quoting from Brueggemann, in order to have access to the Ark and to its old significance, even conservative Israelites with long memories and keen theological sensitivity must make their pilgrimage to Jerusalem, the new city with David's new power and new ideology. They have nowhere else to go. To make contact with the ancient symbol, they must give tacit assent to the new royal apparatus. Or to put it bluntly, David hijacks the Ark. He hijacks the Ark. Now that may seem cynical, but God works through human history, often through rather unsavory characters, as we saw extensively last week. God is not bashful to utilize violence to achieve his purposes through human agents or independently on his own, as we'll see in just in a few moments. But let's not ascribe too much cynicism to David, because he's consistently shown a pattern of reverence and awe before God, of humility and faithfulness. So I think that for him, the idea of bringing the Ark to Jerusalem is one that brought him legitimacy, yes. Had a political impact, yes. Certainly reinforced the idea that he was chosen by God and actually had the courage and the wisdom and the confidence to put the Ark in a proper place, yes. But I think for David, this also was something that he wanted and felt like he needed, that without it, he could not truly be a king. So as they're transporting the Ark, just this enormous celebration breaks out. You know, think about a reverent form of Mardi Gras. you know, or, you know, Louisville or Kentucky winning a national championship without the burning couches. And, I mean, it's just sheer, pure joy, except for Uzzah. We all have to feel bad for Uzzah. They're carrying the ark in a cart, led by a couple of oxen, and the cart starts to sort of shake and wobble, and it looks like the ark's going to fall out of the cart. And you don't want that to happen. You might get dented. It would certainly get dirty if it fell off the cart onto the ground, and that's not how, you know, a sacred artifact's trying to be treated. So to kind of scotch up the ark, Uzzah puts his hand out to support it and keep it from falling off the cart. Naturally, he was killed instantaneously for his good deed. None of them go unpunished. And it upsets David. In fact, it says in the New Revised Standard Version that David was angry. We don't think he was angry with God. He was just angry at the situation. You know, you don't have to be angry at a person to be angry at a situation. And, you know, Uzzah did not deserve to die. There are a lot of explanations that have been offered, none of them satisfactory to me. It just seems as if, as we know full well from Exodus and from Joshua, that this ark was a repository of such great power, and it was so holy that nobody could touch it. Even the Levitical priests had to carry it with these poles. Remember, I know it's been a while that we talked about this, but you got the ark. It's made of acacia wood. It's covered in gold inside and out. Has the tablets. Has some other things in it. It's about 4 feet wide, 2.5 feet tall, 2.5 feet thick. And it's got these rings where you slide these gold-plated poles, and you carry it by the poles. You don't touch the ark itself. Not even the Levitical priest could do that. But you carry it by the poles. And this guy is neither a Levite, and he's not touching the pole, he's touching the ark, so Zappy's dead. And it's it's not so much about Uzzah as about reinforcing God's sovereignty. And we see that David gets the clue about who's in charge in chapter 6, verse 9. When witnessing Uzzah's death, he says, "How can the ark of the Lord come into my care?" You know, He's terrified by what he's seen. And again, that shows that this isn't just a power play on his part, but there really is a deep sense of humility and awe. And to the extent that he calls the procession off, he says, "Okay, everybody go home, put your cymbals and your castanets away, because this thing is giving me the heebie-jeebies, and so we're going to just find somebody like Abinadab who will hold on to it for a little while." And he does. He founds the house of Ebed-Edom, a Gittite, not an Israelite, a Gittite, who probably had no clue what he was getting himself into. Poor guy. And he says, "Okay, yeah, I'll let it stay here." And for 3 months it does. And so you have this uncircumcised, non-Israelite. He's keeping hold of the ark. He's probably got, like, you know, a big post-it note saying "no touchy" on it somewhere. And David learns, you know, this house has been greatly blessed by God, which would have been surprising for God to bless this, you know, these people who are not part of the covenant. David says, "Oh, well, how much more then would the ark's presence bless me and my kingdom?" So he goes down and they resume the procession. And after the first 6 steps, they stop and they make a blood sacrifice, probably on some kind of improvised altar, similar to what we see in 1 Samuel chapter 14, verses 33 and 34. All these citations are in your notes, by the way. I'm just doing it for the benefit of folks who may be listening online. But it's not every 6 steps that they stop and sacrifice an animal. It's just these first 6 steps, and then they move on. Otherwise, this procession would have taken years. There was a feast, and people were playing music, and everybody was dancing, including David. His first wife, Michal, daughter of Saul, was not too happy about his dancing. She thought that it was scandalous behavior for a king. It's not really clear what upset her.
you know, there's been a lot of speculation that David was dancing naked or only with his loincloth on, which would be roughly the ancient equivalent of dancing around in public with your tighty-whities on, or maybe that he was wearing a garment and had a wardrobe malfunction. Nobody really knows, and it doesn't really matter. I think that she's upset because David's behavior it cuts too close to home. It reminds her of when her dad lost control in 1 Samuel chapter 10, verses 9 through 13, and again in 1 Samuel chapter 19, verses 20 through 24, where he got caught up in this prophetic ecstasy. That's not how she wanted her husband to display himself as king. So she's criticizing him very early on in his reign for his behavior. And it's interesting that in this passage, it consistently three times refers to Michal, not as David's wife, but as daughter of Saul. Daughter of Saul. Now, for some, this suggests that she still had loyalty to her father and therefore presented a potentially competing claim to the throne. But that just doesn't, you know, hold any water for me. Because remember, she conspired to keep David safe. You know, she found out that her dad had sent some guys to kill him, and she lowers him through a window in a basket, out the back door to get him to safety. She actively conspired with her brother Jonathan against their father Saul to advance David's interests. And so I think that what this scene is doing is it's showing that David doesn't need her anymore. She's been very important to him as daughter of Saul to put him in a place where he has a rightful claim to the throne. But he doesn't need that anymore. And that's emphasized by the fact that David's claim to legitimacy comes through Yahweh alone. And Yahweh punishes Michal for her... presumptuousness. By making her barren from that day forward until the end of her life, which is probably the worst curse that could have befallen a woman at that time, because they saw a woman's inability to bear children as a curse from God. Yes, fire away.
Well, it says that when it talks about Michal had no child, it says probably because David had no relations with her, her children would have been Saul's heirs and a threat to David's throne.
That's a possibility as well. I mean, it's possible that David got so angry with her that, they were not going any farther than pillow talk if they even had that. It could be taken either way. It's the wondrous thing about Scripture. You can read it in a number of different ways, and both could have been true. So chapter 7 raises the problem about what do you do with the ark? Okay? We got it into Jerusalem, but where do we stick it? Well, you start out with a tent. And this is not that elaborate, glorious, beautiful tabernacle described in Exodus. We're not really sure what happened to that, but much like the ark in the future narrative, which just kind of disappears, at some point along the way, the tabernacle just poofed. And you stopped hearing about it anymore, so presumably something happened to it. I don't see why, if you still had a perfectly good tabernacle at your disposal, you wouldn't put it to some use. And David feels bad because he's in this nice, cozy house that, you know, built with the cedar from Tyre that King Hiram had sent him. And here's God's ark, God's dwelling place, you know, stuck off in this little Boy Scout tent. And so he wants to build a temple. And Nathan encourages him in this. But the very same night, God came to Nathan, probably in a dream, and he says, no temple for me. You are not going to lock me up in a box. I'm too free. I move where I choose. The ark may be my dwelling place, but that does not mean it is the only place where I can be. Instead, I will build a house for David. Not a literal house. David's already got one. That's why he feels guilty in the first place. But in this case, the house that God refers to in his oracle to Nathan is a dynasty. And this is odd. Because in 1 Samuel, God made it quite clear at the establishment of the monarchy that the kings would not be chosen by bloodline, but they would be selected by God through a prophet. That's how it happened with David. You know, Saul was not next. I'm sorry, Jonathan was not next. God sent Samuel on a covert mission to select David. But here, you know, we talked about this extraordinary covenant that God forges with David through this oracle. He decides that David's future heirs will be the only eligible king. So it's a bit of a reversal, but not quite. It's essentially, instead of choosing the successors one at a time through a prophet, God has chosen through Nathan all of the future kings by building a dynasty in David. Okay, this, of course, is a very useful episode to include in the text to justify the fact that David's blood heirs continue to succeed him. And again, this unconditional agreement is the basis of all messianic thought in Judaism and Christianity. As we are fully familiar, the authors of the New Testament go to great pains to demonstrate Jesus as son of David. Both the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke have genealogies that are there specifically to ensure people are aware that he's of the house of David. Jesus has to be born in Bethlehem so that it's made clear that he is of the house of David, even though the reason for getting him into Bethlehem has no real basis in fact, or even common sense for that matter. Paul goes to great lengths to demonstrate that Jesus is of the line of Abraham and David. And it's not just about David, though. It's about Israel, too, because king and nation are going to be closely interwoven. And in chapter 7, starting with verse 9, and this starts in the middle of a sentence, I know, "And I have been with you wherever you went, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, so that they may live in their own place and be disturbed no more. And evildoers shall afflict them no more, as formerly," read the Philistines, "from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel, and I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house." Okay, so you got a bit of a sandwich there. The oracle to Nathan speaks to David that he's going to make a house of him and that he's going to transcend all others. But in the middle, there are great promises for Israel as well. It's through the king, anointed by God, that the nation prospers. And the nation's prosperity is a confirmation of the legitimacy of the king. Does that make sense? And then you sort of see a parallel to this in chapter 7, verses 22 through 24, where David is responding to the oracle of God given to Nathan, which Nathan has told to David. And so he goes to the ark and he's praying to God, "Therefore you are great, O Lord God, for there is no one like you, and there is no God beside you, according to all that we have heard with our ears. Who is like your people, like Israel? Is there another nation on earth whose God went to redeem it as a people and to make a name for himself, doing great and awesome things for them by driving out before his people nations and their gods? And you established your people Israel for yourself to be your people forever, and you, O Lord, became their God." And so basically what you've got is God is an incomparable God, and because of that, Israel is an incomparable people. There is no one else like them. And so you have this interweaving of nation, king, and God. And this is a primary theological claim. I mean, 2 Samuel chapter 7 is easily overlooked, but it is central to the theology of Judaism from the establishment of the monarchy on. So we get through this beautiful prayer by David, which again demonstrates his sense of awe before the majesty of God, his humility. And in 8, we have a sequence of wars, basically. Again, these were offensive. David and Israel are taking the initiative. They're not reacting to events that are foisted upon them. It mentions the Philistines, which is probably a reference back to chapter 5. And then, basically, he goes east, northeast, north, and south against the Moabites, Zobah, Hamath, and Edom in those orders. And he wants to secure their borders. He wants money, gold, bronze, women, camels, sheep, goats, whatever he can get his hands on. He also wants to possess these trading routes because you can impose tariffs on movements of goods and people. And, of course, the more people he beats, the more it burnishes his already strong image as a warrior, consistently led to victory because of God's favor. This is a lot of territory, okay? We're talking a pretty good chunk of Lebanon, most of what we would now call Syria. Hamath was a city about 120 miles. Was it 120 miles or 120 kilometers? I can't remember.
Miles.
Hamath was about 120 miles north of Damascus. Okay, so we're talking pretty close to the current Syrian-Turkish border, maybe even across that border. I'm sorry, but I didn't look it up. Now it's not necessarily that they occupied this territory. These could have sort of become satellite or vassal states that owed David tribute. But it just shows how extraordinarily better they were under David's leadership. Now, David treated people nasty, but this was pretty much the standards of his day. I mean, when he beat the Moabites, he executed two-thirds of the prisoners in a very arbitrary way. And this is really strange because if you'll remember back in 1 Samuel chapter 23, verses 3 through 4, you know, as he's playing this cat and mouse game with Saul, to get his parents safe, he takes them to Moab. And people are like, why would he take them there? Well, because in Ruth chapter 4, verses 21 through 23, we're told that David's great-grandmama Ruth was part Moabite, which is probably why he took them there. I mean, they were distant relations, and he could expect that they would be sheltered. So what's going on with this, you know, prisoner slaughter with the Moabites is anybody's guess. And then he goes on to Zobah, and now it's the horse's turn. Apparently, these people were heavily reliant on cavalry. Holy Week's coming, so I got cavalry in my brain. These people were very reliant on cavalry and on charioteers, and David wasn't, and so he didn't need so many, so he hamstrung them, which was an incredibly cruel way to treat a horse. And the Arameans come to help Zobah, and he slaughters them, and you know, the detail that he left garrisons in their territories indicates that these were not fully occupied territories that were incorporated into a greater Israel, but they were just sort of vassal states. King Toi up in Hamath, following events, very sensibly offers David tribute. Smart guy, Toi. But he's also pretty pleased because he was no friend of Zobah. And so he was like, I like this guy. He's done to the people of Zobah what I've long wished to do to them. Loaded up with treasure, David goes on to defeat the Edomites. And of course, in chapter 8, verse 14, emphasizes that these victories come from God. The last three verses, four verses of chapter 8, conclude with a review of the Jerusalem power structure, which indicates that it's through these events, the restoration of the Ark to centrality in the life of Israelite worship by bringing it to Jerusalem, the oracle given to Nathan, passed on to David of a covenant that would never die with his household, the sequence of victories. All of this is concluded by delineating the bureaucracy, military, administrative, and religious, including the appointment of some of David's sons as priests, which does not appear to be entirely kosher. But what this tells us is here are the major players, Joab, Jehoshaphat, Zadok, Ahimelech, Sariah, Benaiah. These are the major players. And at this point, he's locked in. His kingship rests on firm foundations, and this gives him the confidence in the first verse of chapter 9, which is where we'll resume next week, for David to ask, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul to whom I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" That shows the completeness of his victory, because he's not even sure if any member of Saul's house is still alive. But he's still willing, under these circumstances of strength, to be kind to some of Jonathan's descendants, if any are still alive, because he promised Jonathan that he would do so. And as we'll see, there is one, and he does so. So questions, comments? What am I missing? It's a lot going on in just this, you know, small chunk of 3.5 chapters.
My finding says that when they carried the ark, the well, 30,000 of them were basically in danger. Other ones, they were not carrying. I guess they weren't carrying on the poles. They put it
in a cart for some reason. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, that was a mistake for everybody, basically.
I'm thinking about all these moves with Nazis trying to get the ark, and everybody who touches it or comes in, they just, you know, explode. It's just fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it should have been carried by four priests, I guess.
Yes.
Put on a cart.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, it's odd, you know, why there would be this divergence from tradition. Maybe nobody wanted to even carry it, but then you have to ask, well, how did they get it on the ark in the first place? They had to use the poles, you know, or in the process of getting on the... I mean, who knows? But, yeah, I mean, I cannot think of another religious artifact that ascribed with the same sort of immense, terrifying, lethal power as the Ark of the Covenant. I just can't. In my study of comparative religions, you just don't run up on anything like the Ark.
Michael, go ahead. I'm sorry, Peter.
As far as the tabernacle, I mean, they were wandering around for 40 years carrying the Ark. I would imagine carrying a large tent like that would have got fairly tedious.
Yeah, and, you know, it just, like the Ark, the tabernacle just fades from the story. And I think part of the reason is that there's, I'm looking for the right verb, because evolution doesn't quite fit, and progress doesn't quite fit. But there's just change. There's just change in the nature of God's covenant relationship with his people. Initially, it is mediated through Moses and the priesthood, and then it becomes mediated through the king and the prophets working in tandem and oftentimes in opposition to one another. And as the mediators of the covenant change, certain things like the tabernacle and the ark fade from view because they're less important.
I was going to say, Michael, if you move the Ark to Jerusalem, Israel territory, so to speak, right? Why is there so much question about it today, whose territory it is?
Well, You know, remember, for David to occupy Jerusalem, he had to defeat the people who were inhabiting it in the first place.
But he did.
And he did. But later on, that territory was conquered by others. Greeks, Romans, Muslims, Christians,
yeah.
Muslims. And so that city has changed hands, you know, like a quarter. Just back and forth from one people to another. The claim that Islam would place on Jerusalem was that Muhammad ascended into heaven on a horse from the Holy Mount of Jerusalem, and that this signifies that, you know, Jerusalem is a sacred site for Muslims, secondary, of course, to Mecca and Medina, which played a much more prominent historical role. Israelis would say, we were there first, and our scripture, which, you know, you Muslims, you know, interpret differently, but still validate as sacred, not as sacred as the Quran, but still sacred, you know, clearly demonstrates that it was God's will for us to occupy this place. So everybody has a reasonable basis to stake a claim.
This may never have an answer.
I don't think it will. I mean, the only thing that I think everybody agrees on is that Jerusalem is a holy place that really belongs to God. Then the question is, which people belonging to which religion belong to God?
There you go.
That's the really tough part. Because Christianity, Islam, and Judaism are exclusivistic religions. You know, these are three religions that are my way or the highway.
Yeah.
They're highly exclusivistic. So you can't acknowledge the other two as legitimate. So there can't be any sharing.
Yeah.
In chapter 7, there's verses 10, the Lord is promising David these things. And he says, I will plant them so that they may dwell in their place without further disturbance. And he said, I hate the Philistines. Neither shall the wicked continue to afflict them as a bed of old. I will give you rest from all of your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lord reveals that he will establish a house for you. Well, as Christians, we see Jesus as descendant from the house of David, and he is king.
Mm-hmm.
And Israel has not acknowledged him as king.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps this is why they're still squabbling with the Philistines, with the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the seeds of our current controversy are planted in Scripture. The fact that the firstborn of Abraham wasn't Isaac.
Yeah,
it was Ishmael, who Muslims view as their sort of patriarchal ancestor, and they feel cheated out of their rightful covenant inheritance from God through Abraham, whom they also revere. And you see this sense of David being son of God, you know, which is the ascription that Jesus had, son of David, son of God. You see this in verse 14. I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. And this is a veiled reference to Solomon. When he commits iniquity, I will punish him with the rod such as mortals use, with blows inflicted by human beings. But I will not take my steadfast love from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. So, in other words, unlike other ancient religions, just say, we'll pick on the Egyptians, where the Pharaoh was considered to be son of God, very much in a literal sense. Here, metaphorically, through adoption, God is telling David that, unlike Saul, you and your successor will be my sons through adoption. You couldn't have a more intimate relationship. And David's sons succeed him because David is son of God by adoption. And it was that interpretive matrix that led early Christians to a lot of their conclusions and to their apologetic arguments, trying to explain why this Messiah, who behaved in a way no one expected, actually is the true Messiah. And so you got to tick the boxes. And the big box, you know, near the very top of the list is, yeah, he is in the lineage of David. You have to have that, okay, to be eligible. I mean, that's as primary as a job that requires you to have a PhD. You ain't got no PhD, you're wasting your paper applying for it. If they say straight up, you got to have a PhD, you know. And the same thing with Messiah. You're not in the lineage of David, don't even bother trying. Or Mary, depending on which gospel you read and how you read that gospel. Yeah. Well, exactly. And that's why, and I can never remember whether it's Matthew or Luke, but you know, basically what you've got is one taking him through Joseph, one taking him through Mary, because since Joseph doesn't appear to have been involved in Jesus' birth, it would make more sense for the Davidic, yeah. Yeah, Matthew has him going through Joseph and Luke. These things just get smushed in your head at Christmas time. Yeah. How are we doing on time? Oh, we got 10 minutes. It's all the time in the world.
Whoops. I may have missed this or didn't write this. That time you remember Nathan being mentioned.
Yeah, he pops up out of nowhere.
I mean, Samuel was around, and we were still reading the book of Samuel.
Yeah.
And now suddenly Nathan's on the scene.
Yeah.
We haven't heard where he comes from, who he is, or anything.
We basically know nothing about him, but he plays an enormous role.
Yes.
Throughout 2 Samuel and beyond. And there's a lot of speculation about who he was and where he came from, but I mean, he just sort of comes on the stage like through a trapdoor or something, and poof, there he is. And you know, from the very outset, you know, receives this immense oracle that he then delivers to David after having given David bad advice. You know, that's what I love about it. You know, it's like, you know, a temple would be a great idea, you know. And then that night, it's like, God's like, no, it wouldn't. but here's what I'll offer you instead. I don't need a house from you, but you need a house from me, and I'll provide it for you through David.
There was a documentary announced on television just recently, a couple of years ago, I think, on the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about how many people are his followers. I said, whoa, wait a minute. They're not his followers.
I think that the Pope would agree with you on that, yeah.
Yeah. Somebody doesn't understand who's making that documentary, or at least making the promo for it.
Yeah. It's a persistent danger, and not just with people, you know, like the Pope. And You know, you see it in parishes. I mean, when a rector leaves a congregation for whatever reason, during the interim period, you see a contraction in the size of the parish. And part of it's because of all the uncertainty and this, that, and the other, but a lot of it is because people were at the parish principally because of their relationship with the rector. And that's painful. You know, when I came here, a parish I served in Virginia went through a period of contraction. And I knew that it's because, for some people, their principal relationship to that parish was me. And I view that as a personal failure, because I wasn't able to do my job of directing people beyond me to Jesus.
You know, I think that's kind of a common thing in groups. You'll have one person in a group that is the pollution factor for that group. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that in, say, like the sealed group reunions. Mm-hmm. If someone is holding it together and they disappear, mm-hmm, for whatever reason, it falls apart.
Oh, yeah, it happens in basically any communal context where leadership is exercised, and it's hard to have a communal context without leadership. And, you know, part of the problem as we move forward was the fact that people took their cues from the king instead of from the covenant. And in a way, the king became a sort of idol, because the king began to introduce idols into the worship of the nation, which people then imitated. And so they were following the king instead of following their God, who strongly prohibited idols in the first two of the Ten Commandments.
Were you going to say something? No, I was looking around to see who was as old as I am.
Me?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about Father Board.
Yeah.
And I don't think that I ever had any kind of personal feelings about his leadership in the parish, but I still came here.
Well, I think he was here so long. He was 40 years.
Yeah.
And, at least personally, you know, at some point in time, he is going to move on, mm-hmm, whether he retires or whether he goes out in a box or both.
Yeah.
So I just think, after 40 years, you just sort of think, okay, it's time. But I think in subsequent priests we have had, when Jim Law was here, mm-hmm, we certainly had a contraction when he, I mean, we really split because of the prayer book primarily,
yeah,
at that point in time. And Father Joe, even though it was not his doing to leave, people left because they loved him.
Yeah, but I was thinking of way back.
Way back. No,
I think probably way back.
Well,
that
was,
didn't happen. It was just more of a figurehead.
Yeah, and most people, well, you know, in the time of Father Board, it was a very different era where loyalty to denomination and congregation was much stronger than it is today. Mm-hmm. And people are much more likely to shift allegiances with very little, if any, provocation, whether positive or negative, just because we have a very different philosophy of association than we had, you know, as recently as 30 or 40 years ago. And most people have a loyalty to the community and more broadly to God, because I'm sure we've all heard the phrase uttered to priests. I've had it said to me, I was here before you got here and I'll be here when you're gone. You know, but there is that minority who, you know, the personal relationship with the priest is primary, and that's unfortunate, because it's a sign of, you know, to me it's a sign of me not getting out of the way adequately for a person to maintain their focus on Jesus. You know?
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know.
Well, okay, there's shared responsibility. Oh. I'll go that far. I'll meet you halfway, Fofo. Shared responsibility.
When I was in Memphis, there was a priest by the name of Dan Matthews who later went on to become rector of Trinity. And he was young, and I was going to a church called Holy Communion, which was very Episcopalian, and everybody had their pew. That was where we were. And so he stood up one Sunday morning and said, "I want you all to look around. This is your parish. I'm a facilitator. And this is where you need to put your emphasis."
Good man.
And I thought, whoa, you know, because he was young and everybody thought he was so cute and fun. And he was. He said, "I'll move on, but don't you lose sight that this is your parish and this is your family."
Yeah.
And that was really something I've always carried with me. So I'm sorry. I'm around you. I'm up there talking to
you. You know, I think it's Father Joe. Some people left because of his method of preaching.
Right.
Some people left because of greed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Staying here, kept the greed alive.
Live.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't a comparison necessarily that caused him to move on.
No.
Yeah, and it was unusual circumstance, yeah.
Unusual.
But don't you think people, I bet they've said it to you, and I've heard them say it, when I came into St. Luke's and heard Michael deliver a sermon. I mean, you were talking to them.
Yeah.
You know, they have to grab hold of something.
True.
And then the baby steps start the other way. And I don't think that has anything to do with you. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I think you're great to bring them in here.
Well, as Bishop White's fond of saying, and that's the thing, is priests are facilitators, and that is what we should be. And for that reason, you know, our impermanence should not translate to the impermanence of parishioners and their connection with a parish, as it sometimes does in transitional situations. But as Bishop White is fond of saying in his sermons, because he's said this several times, seminary professor warned his students, people will come to church looking for Jesus, and what they're going to be stuck with is you. And the idea is to move them on from you to Jesus. I think that's the point of that.